I call the meeting of the Senate Finance Committee to order. Today is April 16th, 2018, 10 a.m. Members present today, co-chair Senator Hoffman.
Good morning.
Senator Olson.
Good morning, Matt. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Stevens.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Von Imhoff.
Good morning.
All right. Senator Ms. Kennan is excused from the morning meeting. As you'll see, the agenda reflects that she left, and I won't break anything because it's been set up that way. So, with that being said, today's agenda, we're going to have House Bill 267 release hunting fishing records to municipalities, and the second item up today will be HB 151, Department of Health and Social Services, Foster Care and Child Protection. And first up this morning, we have Representative Bryce Edgman, his staff, Mr. Tim Clark. And please come put yourself on the record and start with your bill overview, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tim Clark, staff to Representative Edgman. First of all, I'd like to convey his regrets for not being able to be here this morning.
We understand.
Thank you, sir. HB 267 gives municipalities that levy taxes on guided fish and game activities access to records that hunting and sport fish guides submit to state agencies. This would provide local governments a tool to help confirm that such hunting and fishing activities subject to taxes within their jurisdictions are being accurately reported to. It's important to note that all such information released to municipalities would remain strictly confidential at the municipal level, just as it's confidential at the state level.
Mr. Clark, could you hold for 1 minute? I inadvertently forgot to put on the record that Senator Michicki is away on other state business and will be joining us shortly. Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That is the bill in a nutshell, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Committee members, we have two people online as well, but committee members, questions? Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. It says in the sponsor statement, the bill would allow municipalities access to certain records collected by the state. Could you be a little bit more specific, as in what does that access entail, and which records by the state, and how are those going to communicate with one another and protect privacy?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, the hunt records are through the Department of Commerce, where the Big Game Commercial Services Board rests. And the sport fishing records are collected by the Sport Fish Division in the Department of Fish and Game. The confidentiality, which was made explicit in the bill through an amendment in the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee, is backed up by provisions in criminal law that are included in your bill packet that point out that a breach in such confidentiality is a Class A misdemeanor, and all officials at the municipal level are subject to that law. And through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, was there a part three to your question that I'm forgetting, or does that come?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator?
So I don't have to dig into the weeds, but it just says access. So I'm assuming that the files will be shared back and forth in some electronic fashion that will be script protected on a periodic basis. So then municipalities will know how's the money going to flow at that point. So the municipalities then know that these fees were collected by the state. They're doing this to collect fees. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, the fees are collected at the local level.
Okay. Okay.
The access to these records gives the municipalities a cross-referencing tool to learn who has been carrying on activities, hunting and sport fishing activities within their jurisdictions, how long they were there carrying on such activities, and the number of people in their guided groups that were collecting those activities. So in terms of how often they would trouble the state agencies for these records, in all likelihood it would simply be once a year as they try to true up their revenues.
Thank you.
Mr. Clark, if the members of the committee, I'd like him to go through a brief sectional. It's not very long. If we could do that right now, Mr. Clark, that'd be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 1 amends statutes on the confidentiality of hunt records and activity reports to add municipalities to those entities already allowed access to such information. Section 1 also makes it explicit that municipalities would be required to maintain the confidentiality of the records, and the section limits municipalities' access to hunt records to those describing activities occurring within 4 calendar years preceding the request for them. Section 2 gives the Department of Commerce authority to charge a municipality a fee for accessing hunt records should expenses to the department warrant one. Section 3 amends statutes on the confidentiality of records and reports required by the Department of Fish and Game to include that a municipality is allowed access to records and reports of guided sport fishing activities if the municipality levies a tax on such activities and requests the reports for the purposes of verifying taxes payable. Section 3 also limits municipalities' access to sport fishing records to those describing activities occurring within 4 calendar years preceding the request. Section 4 gives the Department of Fish and Game authority to charge a municipality a fee for accessing sport fishing records should expenses to the department warrant one. And Section 5 provides an immediate effective date.
Thank you. Senator Stevens?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we need to get on the record why this needs to be done and the problem that it solves. Could you give us some specifics? There's been an issue in the past that we should know about.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stevens, the simplest answer to that is the Lake and Peninsula Borough, which brought this issue to us, believes with some confidence that they may be seeing between $50,000 and $100,000 a year in foregone revenue due to unpaid local taxes. If you consider that the borough's annual budget is around $3 million, then that foregone revenue is significant to them.
Thank you. We do have Lake and Penn Borough, Susan Edwards from King Salmon online, and John Erickson, City Borough of Yakutat, and Mr. Ray D. Bard Delbin from the Kenai Professional Guides for testimony. If it's the will of the committee, why don't we just have them come online since they've kind of, they're the genesis behind this legislation, I believe. Is that accurate, Mr. Clark?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Why don't we just spool them up and get them on public testimony right now and hear their concerns. All right, let's go to, we'll just start at the top and go to the Kenai Professional Guide Association. Ray, can you put your name on the record, because I butchered it?
Yes, sir. Chairman Hoffman, Senate Finance Committee, thanks for the opportunity to speak here today. My name is Ray DeBartoleben with the Kenai River Professional Guide Association. So pretty brief here from our point. Logbooks were created for Alaska Department of Fish and Game to gather biological data, and it's private and privileged information. That being said, having logbooks to create accurate, if you take logbooks to create accurate information, the fisheries are so dynamic, different in each sport fishery varies dramatically according to the time of year, the type of equipment used, and different locations we go fishing. So I just don't think it would be a great idea to have this be a tool to be used to compare for that. And so also our borough, I think, has programs set up to make sure that the taxes are being collected. So that's, in a nutshell, basically what I have. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions from committee members? All right, seeing none, we'll go to John Erickson, City Borough of Yakutat. Mr. Erickson.
Good morning, and thank you so much for taking my testimony. Yakutat, our situation and the reason we support this bill is because our borough is quite long, around 200 miles to the west and about 150 miles to the, southwest. And with that, we have access to the borough, to the Sayu area, which we have five lodges up there, which we collect taxes. And last year we collected around, right around $78,000 in sales tax and probably around $12,000 in bed tax, according to my records. But we have numbers of other people accessing by plane, and they do not come through the borough. They come directly from Cordova or Anchorage. And so we have no idea who's coming, who's using the resource, who's hunting, who's fishing. Likewise, to the south or southwest, we have the Dry Bay area. And I've talked to the state park fish and game, he's a state park trooper, and he is always checking logbooks and said that it's just hard to keep track of and many of the logbooks aren't completed. So this just gives us an idea of what kind of revenue and what kind of activities are taking on the borough, and, do we need to send enforcement? Do we need to put people on the ground? We don't have a fish and wildlife trooper anymore, so it's kind of putting the impetus on us. And since our borough is so long and since we're so lightly staffed, this gives us an idea of who's operating within the borough. And as far as HIPAA, as far as keeping confidentiality, we keep HIPAA, FERPA, personnel records. We're very, very careful about that. We have TSA import security things, all under lock and key, and this would be no different than that. Thank you so much for your time. If you have any questions, I'm willing to answer them.
Senator Stevens has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So can you give us an idea, Ms. Erickson, of what you expected the revenue that you have lost might be? Any thoughts there? And then further, how would this be collected? It would be through your personnel. Is that true? Is that the way it would work?
It would give us an idea of we have, let's say for the Sayu area and those lodges, the Sayu lodges are, and that area is accessed by Anchorage or by Cordova also. What we would do with that is it gives us an idea of who else is operating. And we have three or four lodges that are leased right now. And because they're leased, we know who they are, and we are able to keep track of them. Anyone else operating up there, we have no idea. We would have to have someone on the ground to do that. I would say, if we can get a handle on this, that it would probably double our revenue. We'd probably go from roughly, my figures right here say 88,500. I would think we would at least be able to increase that by 50%, so another 40,000.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, John. I know that the community needs to be able to retrieve all the legitimate revenues that it is due, and so I certainly support you in this. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson. Next, we're going to go to Susan Edwards, Lake and Peninsula Borough, King Salmon. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. The Lake and Peninsula Borough has had a guide use tax for some years now. our borough, like Yakutak, is very large, roadless. Our entire finance office is just two people. Without these records, there's no way we can be sure of what is being reported to us is correct, and we can't really be sure of having everyone who is guiding in our borough reporting correctly to us. As far as confidentiality, which has been a concern, the borough's code is very explicit about the confidentiality of tax information. Certainly, we run our office as professionally as possible. And I believe the amendment adding a penalty for a breach of confidentiality more than addresses this issue. I would really urge the committee to look favorably upon this bill, and I would be willing to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Committee members, any questions? Senator Stevens, thank you for
that. Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry for taking up all these questions, but I'd be curious to know, if you were to find that the folks are not reporting as they should from when you get the records from the state, what would you do about it? What is your recourse? How would you handle getting those funds?
Well, our process now is to go to the guide and saying, this is the information we have. This is the information you reported to us. We believe that you are in arrears in tax reporting, and we would like to handle it as, a negotiation as best we can. However, the borough does have penalties and fines for late and false reporting as a backup to that. And if necessary, which we really don't want to do, there's always litigation. But I think that with the having access to these records, that really will decrease any need for any sort of punitive action on part of the borough, mainly because these are the reports that the guides themselves are reporting. So, they can't say they were wrong.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. I have one. Ms. Edwards, do you have any idea what do you think might be in lost revenue leaking out of the borough?
We've looked at this pretty closely and feel fairly confident that should this bill pass and we have this, our revenue would increase between $50,000 and $100,000 a year.
Okay, thank you. And one more question from myself. And how much of outreach and recruitment, how much of an outreach do you do to guides in the borough, educating them on the process?
We have worked extremely hard to reach out and educate our guides. 4 years ago, when we really began this process, we had about 40 guides registered with the borough. At this juncture, we have just hunting guides, well over 120 guides.
All right. Okay, thank you. Any other questions from committee members? Seeing none, we're going to close. I think that's everybody for public testimony. Ms. Chambers is just here in the room for questions only, it appears. So we're going to close public testimony, and we're going to hold the fiscal note review. That'll be held over, and last but not least, any amendments, concerns to the chairman's office by noon tomorrow, Chair McKinnon. So with that, we're going to take a brief at ease and set up the PowerPoint. Senate Finance is back to order. Good morning, Representative Guerra. If you want to bring yourself and your staff to the table, put yourself on the record. We're going to talk about introduce HB 151 and foster care child protection. And however you want to roll here, a brief overview, but I would love to, and the committee members like to get into your slides and see those. We have reviewed them, but we would like to hear you walk through those.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm just trying to figure out how to make the PowerPoint work. There we go. Are you ready, Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir. Put your name on the record, you and your staff, and we'll go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Les Guerra, District 20.
And my name is Michelle Seidman. I'm staff to Representative Guerra.
Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair. With this 100-year-old quote, Michelle wouldn't let me put in the word women in there, so that's the 100-year-old quote. Just so committee members know, we shortened the PowerPoint quite a bit in respect for your time. The full PowerPoint is in your packets. A substantial amount of evidence is in your packets, and we'll refer to that as much as we can. The other thing we tried to do to save committee time is a number of people wanted to testify, and we've tried to limit it to the sort of most key experts on the issue. Just in recognition of your time. So though the Mental Health Trust was interested in testifying, the All-Alaska Pediatric Partnership, the Children's Trust, their letters of support are in the packet. The Casey Family Programs they're the largest foster care nonprofit in the country. They operate in all 50 states, and I went to a conference there last year. And their mantra is this: a child protection system should provide customer service. They shouldn't be engaged in crisis management. But in most states, foster care systems are engaged in crisis management. And whatever concerns folks have about the Alaska system, they are repeated in most states. But there are some states that have done it right. And that's what we want to do here. The bill is very much about limiting damage to children, limiting trauma to children, limiting damage to families, including the original families who would like to get reunification created for family reunification. And in the long term, it's about saving money, reducing the number of youth in foster care who we have to pay for. And we have followed a New Jersey model. And the New Jersey model involves caseload standards, so that you don't keep burning out caseworkers who in Alaska burn out at a rate of about 49% within a year. And we're paying for basically empty positions. You train them, you recruit them, and you lose them before you get the benefit from them. That is not a wise use of money. In New Jersey, they've reduced their turnover rate to 7%. So I'll start going through the bill. The bill is evidence-based. In the packet, you'll see documents from Casey Family Programs on their studies, documents from the Children's Bureau, which is the federal foster care entity that studies foster care, the National Child Welfare Workforce Institute, Harvard University, and others. Here's what we're facing right now. We have a system that incarcerates 29% of our foster youth. That costs money. 53% end up homeless at some point in their lives. That costs money. 37% before age 21 have children on their own. And that is probably not in all circumstances a healthy statistic. 40% end up using public assistance. And only 34% end up becoming employed. That's not the system that we want. We want a system where foster youth have the same success rates as our own children. So what did they do in New Jersey? I've told you they adopted caseload standards so caseworkers aren't overwhelmed, and so caseworkers who are overwhelmed don't then leave the system because they're burned out, so you don't have this massive turnover rate where you're paying basically to train workers and recruit them and lose them. In New Jersey, they've reduced the number of youth in foster care by almost 50%. In New Jersey, caseworker turnover is down to 8% from 25%. They've reduced it 67%. Two-thirds. What else have they done in New Jersey? When you have caseworkers who have time to work with youth as opposed to engage in crisis management and jump from one crisis to the next crisis, excuse me, and not work with families, excuse me, You have time to do one of the most important things that occurs in the foster care system. A caseworker who has time when a child comes into the system or when a child is shifted from one unfamiliar family to another, to another, to another, you're supposed to look to see if there's a family member out there, a grandmother, an aunt, a cousin, a friend of a family. Those placements work much better for foster youth. But even though we have that requirement in the law that you're supposed to look for a family member, caseworkers overwhelmed are not able to do the family searches and the friend of family searches. And so what you have is a child from Kotzebue or Bethel or Fairbanks ending up being placed in a strange foster home with strange people that they don't know, and you place them with a few of those families, and all of a sudden those youth develop a detachment disorder, a distrust of adults. They see a new caseworker, a new family, and it causes massive damage. And we all know about ACEs scores. But in New Jersey, they increase the placement with families through having the time to do the searches. That's another great thing that happened in New Jersey. What happens when you have excessive caseloads? This bill is not about money. It's about allowing people to do casework to get families, kids back to their original families or into a permanent loving home, or what Amanda Mativier, you'll hear from her, calls a forever home, a place where they'll be loved, a place where they'll be able to be raised in a way where they won't end up on public benefits. Without the time, you can't work to engage in frequent visitation. If you set up frequent visitation with the family that lost their child, they are much more likely statistically to get that child back. And you get the child out of foster care that way, back to their original family, and that's the greatest thing you can do. High caseloads, the evidence shows, leads to high turnover, and high turnover leads to wasted money in the foster care system. And when you lose workers who leave the system, that just results in this endless cycle of them transferring all their cases to already overwhelmed caseworkers, and you have this vicious cycle of work that doesn't happen. The majority of people who leave OCS, this 45 to 49% right now of people who leave OCS within a year, they have cited excessive caseloads as the number one reason why they leave. It's no surprise. The more turnover you have, if we don't solve this, the more repeat child abuse and repeat child neglect you have. That's nationally, that has been studied, because you don't have people familiar with the family who are able to watch out for these children and recognize the signs of abuse and neglect. And so that's what we get with more turnover. You have inadequate time to investigate cases. You make mistakes when you investigate cases. And you sometimes take children out of a home who should not be taken out of a home. Those are all the ills that happen when you engage in crisis management and jump from fire to fire to fire. One national study, this is from the National Child Welfare Workforce Institute, one of the federal entities that studies foster care. They estimate the cost of turnover, losing and then having to recruit and then having to train a new worker and then losing a new worker, at about $54,000 per worker that you don't really get work out of. And that is a waste of money, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. But what happens when you create a stable workforce like they have in New Jersey through caseload limits and the other things they've done? You get the bottom yellow bar is you get with one worker, a child who has just one worker instead of this rotating series of workers, gets into permanency of a permanent loving home over 75% of the time, in a timely basis, instead of languishing in the foster care. Two workers, it goes down to 17.5% of these youth end up in a loving home in a timely basis. And then the more workers this child has, the less likely they are to ever get out of the foster care system on a timely basis, and the more likely they are to be damaged. That's the damage of caseworker turnover, getting new workers who don't understand the case.
So, Representative Guerra, yeah. On that slide 8, I just like to, I don't know if there's an analogy there, but just to help make this slide's point, I think there's a connection. Students in Finland stay with the same teacher for 7 years, and their students score the highest in the world on the PISA test. So there's probably a connection here. I would agree. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to go through, because in this abbreviated slide, I didn't list for you all the other good things that are happening in New Jersey, a system that was worse than the system we have here. They actually adopted their reforms because a court ordered them to. That's not what you want here. This is what happened in Jersey. Fewer placement changes. That's healthy for children. Reduction of youth in foster care by 45%. That's good for the state, and that's good for children. The number of family placements with aunts and grandmothers went up 35%. That's good for children. Reunification, 40% of youth are reunified within the first year with their original family, so you don't have the system where you take children away from families and they never go back. They reduced the youth number of youth waiting to be adopted by 44%, waiting for a loving home, ready for a loving home. They reduced that number who just languish in foster care by 44%. They've set state records for the number of youth who are adopted, reduced the number of youth removed from their families because they're able to do a valid investigation and they don't make the mistakes you make when you don't have adequate investigators. They've significantly reduced the amount of neglect and abuse of children in foster care because you don't have the turnover. They've increased staff morale. If you want workers to stay around, you can't have them going home having nightmares about all the cases they didn't get to work on and all the things they didn't get to do, but that's what happens in this state and in most states. And like I said, they've reduced turnover by about two-thirds.
Thank you.
This is what the bill does. It's A, number one, aimed as a fix to the major problems we have to improve family outcomes, but it's also aimed to reduce waste and red tape. We set manageable caseload limits, and I've told you why that's important. For new workers, like they do in New Jersey, similar to what they do in New Jersey, new caseworkers who don't know their job yet, who don't know how to do their job, we limit their caseloads to 6 cases in the first 3 months as they're learning their job and as they're being trained, and to 12 workers, or to 12 cases in the first 6 months. That's in section 6 of the bill. OCS had recommended, given the big distances we have in New York City, you can go see 5 families a day because you just get on the train or the bus and you go see 5 families. But in Alaska, sometimes you have to go upriver or sometimes you have to get on a plane. And so you can't see as many families. So OCS validly recommends a caseload limit of about 12. We saved about $1 million in the fiscal note by saying 13. It's not something we wanted to do. We had to recognize that's way better than where we are today, and we have a fiscal crisis. And we're closer than ever to being able to achieve these caseload standards and the training standards we have in this bill. By doing that, we are really closer than ever. The bill is consistent with national recommendations on caseloads to reduce turnover. This is where we are right now. We have a number of what we call rotating positions. Somebody comes in, they get hired, they leave. They come in, they get hired, they leave. We have positions like that. And these extra positions, this is where we are. In the biggest office in Anchorage, more than double the caseloads caseworkers can handle. In Barrow, way more than double the caseloads. In Fairbanks, 50% higher caseloads than caseworkers can handle. Just look across the state. In many of our offices, we just cannot meet the workload standards, and therefore we're burning out our caseworkers, losing them, and wasting money on people who barely have learned their jobs. We've talked about the importance of placements with family members. We'll be able to do that. And the bill strengthens the department's duty to search for family members and friends. One of the things it does is it requires a supervisor check off that the worker did it. One anecdote I'll provide you is we knew a caseworker who didn't even know they were supposed to look for family members when they placed the child. The child just got placed. And so we'll have a supervisor check off that the worker actually did the family search. It's the kind of thing that can make Olympians, and I say this because at a Casey Family Programs conference I went to last year that I was invited to, I met two Olympians, Simone Biles and Tori Bowie. They were both foster youth, and they both ended up living with their grandparents within 1 year. They didn't bounce between family to family to family, and I would just bet, not knowing the facts, that they would not have made the strides they made in their lives if they just languished in a foster care system from home to home to home. The bill provides necessary training to caseworkers. Before last year's addition to the budget, OCS was doing about 3 weeks of training for new workers, which was not enough, and everybody recognized that. With the passage of this bill, we'll go up to 6 weeks of training. Most of that training will be done at the University of Alaska's Child Welfare Academy, and you'll hear from somebody who works there, but that is a big improvement. We have added mentors to certain offices, as many as we could within the fiscal constraints that we have, so the caseworkers who are having trouble with their work can go to somebody and speak to them and sit down with them and say, how did you do your job? And OCS will talk to you about the importance of having mentors, and this will stabilize the turnover. And I talked to you about the training will be done at the Welfare Academy. We are looking for other ways to reduce the number of removals. Right now, the law says if there isn't a safe parent to stay with, you get removed from a house. But there might be a safe extended family member at that house that can keep the child safe, a grandparent, an aunt who lives in the house. There are a lot of extended families around the state. And if you can keep a child safely in a home, even though there's not a safe parent, but a grandparent lives there who will keep the child safe, don't take the child out of the home. And so the bill does that. There are important connections for these youth who don't have real families. They just don't. So some of these kids get separated from their siblings. Too many of them get separated from their siblings. The bill requires that siblings get the contact information for their other siblings. Some of the biggest nightmares these youth have is about the siblings that they don't get to see and how they're faring and if they're in trouble. And so we want to encourage connections between siblings. There's a Harvard study that turns the foster care sort of mentality on its head. We used to see foster families as people the child should never see again once they leave that foster home. But some of those foster families have become big influences in a child's life. And if there are healthy foster parents who the child had a bond with, we want to give the child and that family contact information so they can stay in touch with each other. These are children who, when they're 18, 19, 20, 21, go out on the street on their own. They've got nobody to call. They don't have Mr. Chairman. They don't have you to call. They don't have their parents to call. We need to give them a network of people who can be out there. So we're going to say where it's healthy, maintain contact with former foster families who are big parts of a child's life if the child wants. We cut some red tape that will save time at OCS, but also keep us from losing our best foster parents who have to call for permission for 100 things over at OCS. They don't get their calls back because their OCS workers are running from crisis to crisis to crisis. We adopt what 11 states have adopted. It's a federal standard called the Prudent Parent Standard, which says you want to take that child on vacation, you get to take that child on vacation. You don't have to get permission from OCS first. You want to sign up a child for sports, you can sign up a child for sports. You don't have to call up OCS first to get permission. It allows a foster parent to act as a parent, and it'll save foster parent frustration, and we'll be able to keep our best foster parents, which we lose sometimes. Right now, we want to say that a foster care application and a variance application, if your home doesn't meet certain codes, we want the variances and we want the applications decided within the first 45 days if feasible. Sometimes it takes a year or longer for those things to get decided, just given the crisis mode that the system is in. We want to get youth into good homes faster. And it gives youth more of a voice to participate in their case plan and their goal for what their permanent home is going to be. We let them nominate two adults that they know to be on the committee. We let them participate if it's in the child's best interest. And that's a best practice. There's been progress at OCS. I mean, we're getting more kids into college right now. We're getting more kids graduating from college through other reforms that we've taken. It's not like it's all bad news, but we want to bend the curve for everybody else. Last year, their number of discharges, youth discharged from OCS, put into a permanent family, either their original family or an adoptive family, exceeded the number of removals. That was a big deal. That was a very big deal. That's what we want to see at OCS. Mr. Chair, I think I just want to end by reading to you a piece of evidence, if I can find it really quickly. This comes from the National Child Workforce Institute, and I wasn't able to walk you through all of the evidence because I have to have respect for your time unless you want me to walk you through it. But these studies are replicated across the country. But according to the National Child Workforce Institute, one of the federal entities that studies foster care, high caseloads lead to high turnover, which lead to higher neglect and abuse of children, which harm the ability to serve youth and families. You get less family engagement with the original family, and the less family engagement you have, the less chance there is that that family is going to be reunified with their child, so we damage our system that way. You reduce your ability to find and achieve a permanent loving home for the child if it's not going to be the original family. And the worst thing you do is you increase the time of a child in foster care, where they spend their lives with well-intentioned people who are not permanent families, though. It costs the state on a daily basis, the daily rate. It costs children in terms of trauma. And then what the National Child Welfare Workforce Institute says is the high caseloads that lead to high turnover it creates this domino effect that repeats itself over and over and over again with more turnover and more. And then when you turn over, then you have to transfer your cases to an overburdened caseworker already. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I certainly have a lot more. Inside your packet, you have a one-pager that really explains all this evidence, again, from the National Child Workforce Institute, and it talks about this domino effect. But by lowering caseloads and lowering caseworker turnovers, you get all of the good benefits they had in New Jersey, where they've reduced the number of youth in foster care, where they've increased the number of youth that get placed with their families and not strange families, where they've reduced childhood trauma, abuse, and neglect, and repeat abuse and repeat neglect. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we took 2 years putting this bill together to make sure it was evidence-based, to make sure we found the best practices we could in the country so that we could bend the curve and not sit here for the rest of our lives complaining about how things don't work at our system when other states have found a way to make their systems work. With that, I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. Just a brief of these. Okay, we're back on the record. Representative Guerra, that domino slide you had, your bill packet is very comprehensive. I appreciate it. Is that in our slide? Is that in our packet, the domino slide that you held up at the end?
Through the chair, this slide right here?
Yes.
Yes, that's in your packet.
Thank you. All right. What I would like to do now with the committee's latitude is we've pretty much covered the entire sectional, but I think we would like to get into the invited testimony and the public testimony. I think that was really going to bring a lot more personalize it as it was. It was personalized very well. And I'll just say before we move on to that point, when we had the foster students in introductions in the Senate chambers, you know, when one girl said that she'd been placed 44 times, I'm going, that's just not acceptable. So with that being said, invited testimony, Christy Lawton. Christy, if you could come up and put yourself on the record.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Christy Lawton, and I'm the director at the Office of Children's Services. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 151 today. I have had the privilege of being the director for the past almost 8 years now, and for me, the work is truly a labor of love. Recently, I marked my 20th year with OCS, and today I wish to reflect a bit on that history. I started my career in child welfare unofficially in 1996, when I completed my internship for my undergraduate degree at the Fairbanks OCS office. It was then that I was really bit by the child welfare bug. Before that internship, I lived a relatively sheltered and privileged life, having no real conception of the challenges so many Alaskans face, nor the impact that could have on their children. It was a rude awakening to the harshness of real life and how lives can be impacted in the face of poverty, homelessness, mental illness, addiction, and violence. During that experience, I met countless abused and neglected children and parents who hated themselves for being the cause. As an intern, I recall some of my biggest worries being about aggressive dogs and the expansive nature of dog lots in interior Alaska, and the occasionally emotionally explosive parent who would spew every last bit of emotion at you in the heat of a moment. Back then, my day was spent in my car, driving endlessly to find families who didn't want to be found, knocking on a lot of doors with great trepidation, interviewing scared and wary children, while handwriting case notes in between visits, sitting in my car, and doing my best to comply with the myriad of requirements. Some weeks I felt more competent than others, but as a young worker with no partner or kids, I was able to work 10 to 12 hours a day and most weekends to even begin to put a small dent in all the efforts my cases required. There were too many days when I was left feeling like a failure, and just as many nights I lost sleep over it. But in reality, I was a relatively good worker, and soon I had the opportunity to promote to a supervisor. I loved mentoring new caseworkers, but with every bright light that started, it wouldn't be long before you'd begin to see those lights diminish in the face of their overwhelmed workload and the responsibility, and their frustration at not being able to do the job that we hired them to do. Too often, I had to press them to move faster, which meant decreased quality and increased risk for children, because there was always more new cases waiting. A few years later, I found myself in a manager position with even greater authority to make system changes. I worked and still do work with some of the most dedicated and brightest leaders, and we work tirelessly to improve worker retention and improve outcomes for the families we serve. We created committee after committee focused on improving morale. We offer flexible staffing schedules. We piloted new idea after new idea. But although some of those had success, more success than others, none of them could turn the tide to create lasting improvements. As I continued my career, I moved into positions that had statewide oversight, whereby I could directly influence practice, policy, and training. In those roles, I looked for inefficiencies in our processes, for tasks and work we could take off a worker's desk to increase the time for real engagement with families. Improvements and changes were continuously made. With each change, we hoped it would be the thing that would make things better. We also adopted a new practice model with the help of some of the nation's leading child welfare experts. But with all that work and those accomplishments came the continued reality of the workforce problem. The challenges workers face today are on a whole other level than when I started out two decades ago. Today, workers face increasing real and credible threats on their personal safety, both in the office and in the field setting. As director, I can tell you every day is a roller coaster at OCS. I refute strongly claims that OCS is broken and should be dismantled. The word that I would use to describe OCS is that OCS is debilitated. We are a system severely hindered due to lacking the right resources to operate effectively. Workforce retention and child welfare has been a chronic problem for over five decades, as evidenced by a 1960 report by the Children's Bureau calling for states to address their recruitment and retention challenges. Alaska could and should be proactive so that we can develop our own solutions for the challenges our system faces and not wait for it to be a byproduct of a class action lawsuit. This bill provides the best chance at getting alignment in the system for the first time. I urge you to support HB 151. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Committee members, any questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Naughton, as you look at, are you familiar with the New Jersey model that was referenced by the bill sponsor?
Through the chair, yes, I am.
Will it work here in the state of Alaska because the demographics and those kind of things that are quite a bit different than a population that's pretty much centered in one area? Will it work here in the state of Alaska?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I believe it will, yes.
No further questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Olson, Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Lawton, thank you for being here today, and thank you for working on this bill. I think it's a good bill. Of course, we heard this bill in Health and Social Services Department. I don't have any questions now, but after we hear other invited testimony, I think there's a few other folks. My staff and I have put a lot of thought into this bill, and I'd like to present an idea today to you and others in this room that I think that you'll like. Okay, I'm hoping that it's a blend of all the ideas and concerns that we've heard from both bodies and both majority and minority, and I want to make this bill go forward. And so I'm going to hold off on presenting it now because I want to hear a little bit more testimony, and then we're going to have a robust conversation. Okay.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Ms. Lawton. I appreciate your testimony. Next, we're going to go to Amanda Mativer. I said that right.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Thank you. Name on the record and continue, please.
For the record, my name is Amanda Mativier, and I'm testifying on behalf of Facing Foster Care in Alaska. I just want to start by thanking the committee for allowing time for testimony and for hearing this bill. I know you're all incredibly busy. We brought 28 current and former foster youth to Juneau during spring break because House Bill 151 is deeply personal to myself and so many young people in foster care throughout the state. A number of the provisions in this bill came directly from young people who are living in our foster care system right now. I personally am a former foster youth. I aged out of foster care here in Anchorage. I've been a foster parent to teenagers for the last decade, and I'm currently a social worker. I work with youth who are transitioning out of foster care and into post-secondary education and training. This bill, House Bill 151, like I said, is deeply personal for so many of us throughout the state. And the goal, really, of child protection is to keep children safe and move them quickly toward permanency by either reuniting children with their parents or getting children to safe, permanent, loving homes and out of foster care. Unfortunately, a number of the teens I work with right now have spent the majority of their lives in our state foster care system. And aside from the grim statistics of what happens when you age out of foster care and not having someone to call if you get a flat tire, that also means a lot more in terms of legal permanence. When young people don't have legal permanence and they age out of our system, that means they have no next of kin. If something happens to them, they're in a severe accident, there's no one to make a decision. We're talking to 16-year-olds right now about health care directives. They have no one to be grandparents to their children when they start their own families and move on into adulthood. Right now, the average caseworker lasts about a year and a half at the Office of Children's Services. I have a young person who lives in my home right now who's had countless caseworkers in the last 2 years. We tried to sit down and count. We don't even know how many there's been. House Bill 151 would limit caseloads for current staff at the Office of Children's Services, ultimately limiting workload and allowing for more meaningful social work. What does that look like? That looks like quality caseworker visits, actually spending time during home visits, having time to engage with parents, getting them into substance abuse treatment, getting them to work on and look at plan behavior change so that they can work their case plan and successfully work toward reunifying with their children. This bill would drastically reduce the time a child spends currently in foster care. It would reduce the trauma a child experiences while in foster care. If we are able to actually recruit and train caseworkers and limit their workload before someone leaves, if we're able to hire somebody before somebody leaves, we're going to do so much better in terms of being able to serve children and families, and we're going to be able to safely reduce the number of children and youth in foster care. I've been with Facing Foster Care in Alaska now for the last 15 years and have worked on lots of different pieces of advocacy and legislation that has been directed by young people in the system, and I think this is the most comprehensive piece of child welfare reform we've ever actually seen proposed, and we have a big opportunity right now to change our system in Alaska, and I think it starts with this bill. So I hope you all support it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions from committee members? Seeing none, we're going to go back to Juneau in person, and we've got a couple folks here, then we're going to go back online. So Julie Lucky is next up to testify, and Janie Reap will be next.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I know that you are used to seeing me up here doing committee work, but for the record today, I am Julie Lucky, and I am testifying on my own behalf and not for the committee. I'm going to testify today based on my experience as a CASA volunteer, a court-appointed special advocate, which works with the guardian ad litem for children who are in out-of-home placements, and also my brief stint as a foster parent, roles that I hope to return to if I ever get to stay in one community long enough to make that commitment to a child. From my experience, what Representative Guerra said was really true. When my foster child moved into a reliable two-parent foster family of me and my husband, it was almost impossible to get services. And I understand why, because our social worker was too busy making sure that her other cases were fed and were not being neglected. Our foster child was safe in our home, but it made it a little bit more difficult for us to get the services that she needed. I don't have a lot of statistics and a lot of stories about other foster children. I just have my own, so that's what I'll be telling you today. Foster children go through a lot of heartbreaking experiences, and some are obvious. Neglect, abuse, being taken from your home, for reasons that you can't control, by a stranger, to live with other strangers. Sometimes only carrying a garbage bag full of clothes from one home to another. And I have seen this because I have helped them when they have had to leave their home and had to leave their parents. A lot of people don't understand for foster children, getting to live with nice parents like me and my husband is not a treat. It is still being taken away from the family that they love and the family that they know. So, the changes in House Bill 151 can lessen some of the heartbreak. Some of it we can't, but some of the things in House Bill 151 would be incredibly helpful. Getting to move in with a family member or a relative, a friend instead of a stranger. When you're 14 years old and older, feeling like your voice is heard and you have a little bit of input over your fate, or at least a little bit of input over who gets to decide your fate for you. Being able to call your older sibling who might have been really your caretaker in your house to get some reassurance, to find out how they're doing, to tell them you lost a tooth or how you did on your math quiz. And I will tell you, although I was not going to talk much about my foster child because I feel that her story is her own and it's not mine to tell. When she left our home, we had hoped she would find her forever placement, and she didn't, and things went a little bit downhill from there. And 6 months later, I was the one that she called. She had other people as well to call, but I remember she called me, and I took her out to dinner, and I have kept in contact with her as much as I can. She is now in a forever home, which is not mine, and for that, I am a little sad. We tried our best. It wasn't the right placement for her. But she is in a forever home now and doing great, and I still keep in contact, and that... We could do that because she had my cell phone number because she was a teenager. But I just think about a young child in that situation being able to reach out to someone that they lived with for months and having that contact, and how heartbreaking it might be to not be able to tell them when they did their science fair of something that you might have helped them do, or got that final A on the test that you might have helped them with when they were in your home for that short period. And this is probably the most emotional part for me, not having to swallow the bitter disappointment of missing yet another slumber party, field trip, to the state fair. Because unfortunately, the foster mother wasn't able to get the paperwork done in time to hear from that social worker that it was okay to take somebody out of the municipality. And those of you who haven't done foster care, we weren't allowed to take our child out of the municipality of Anchorage without any sort of... without the social worker saying that it was okay. So when we wanted to go to the family fair, I had a horrible decision if I couldn't get in touch with that social worker. Did I break the rules? I am, as you all know, a rule follower, and take her anyway? Or did I cancel the whole trip because I couldn't take that family member with me even though the fair was only in town for a week? And I don't blame the social workers for this. And the reason is because when you have a lot of cases, as Representative Guerra said, you're doing crisis management, not case management. And they have to take care of those children who are not being fed, and those children who are being abused, and not the ones that are safe in a home. But those children do miss out on a lot of opportunities that, with a prudent parent standard, they could take advantage of. So as a parent of biological children, and I know that a lot of you have children of your own, my heart aches when my children have disappointment, hurt, and heartache that I am unable to prevent. But for those of you who have not had foster children, I cannot adequately describe how much worse it felt when my foster child stoically forgave me because she had gotten so used to disappointment. So, in closing, what I would like to say is this bill will have a small effect on most of us. It's a lot of changes in statutes that really won't affect probably most of the people at this table. And if my math is correct, which I'm hoping it is, and I had a couple of people check, but I could be wrong because math is not my strong suit, the fiscal notes will be less than four one-hundredths of a percent of the overall UGF spend in the state, and a little over one-tenth of a percent of the overall UGF spend for the department. So a small cost, but it can really make a big difference in the life of a child who has already been dealt a bad hand in life. I urge your swift passage of House Bill 151 and would be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Next up, we have Janie Reap. Is Janie here?
Janine.
Welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Janine Reap. I live in Douglas, Alaska, and I thank you for allowing me to testify today. I am an attorney who has worked in the field of child protection for over 30 years. For 12 years, I was an assistant attorney general representing OCS, then DFYS. Then I moved over to the Office of Public Advocacy as a guardian ad litem for 13 years, where I was able to represent children in child in need of aid cases. I also supervised the CASA program and had the honor of recruiting and working with Ms. Lucky, who was a wonderful CASA volunteer. For the past 6 years, I've been a mediator in child protection cases. I also handle adoptions for youth who are coming through the OCS system. And I'm currently a member of the board of Facing Foster Care. So in preparing for my testimony, I realized my entire career has been devoted to child protection. And it's very, very important to me. I'm here to testify in support of HB 151 because I think it is likely the single most important piece of legislation affecting child protection that I have seen in my career. I have been saying for decades to my colleagues and other community members that the only thing that is really going to change and improve our child protection system is if there's a statutory cap on caseloads. And now we have a bill that can do that. This legislation, it sounds like a cliche, but it really can improve the lives of the children in foster care. And I was very worried about my time limit. I could talk about this for hours, and I know that's not necessary and there's no time. But I do believe Representative Guerra covered the strong points or the highlights of the bill very, very well. And everything he said is absolutely accurate, and I know that from working day to day with children and social workers in the system. I think being a social worker is, along with a public guardian, is probably the most responsibility-laden job in existence. These people are living with knowing that the job they have, and this may sound overly dramatic, but what they do will likely significantly impact a child's future, their entire life. It's huge. And I think Ms. Lucky talked about what it's like to be a parent, and if anyone who's a parent knows what an awesome, daunting responsibility that is and how you worry about this decision or this school or how it's going to impact your child. The social workers are making decisions that affect who a child lives with. Are they going to live with a family member or a relative? Are they going to live with a stranger? Are they going to have one placement? Are they going to have 17 placements? Are they going to have 44 placements? What kind of an adult is going to come out of a background of 44 placements? Schools, will they get the help they need in school? Will they attend one school? Will they attend 10 schools? Will they be put in residential treatment because they're teenagers and they're exhibiting behavior problems that may be very normal for teenagers, particularly those who are experiencing trauma and loss, but they're placed in residential treatment centers not because they have evil social workers who don't want to help them, but because there's no time to find the right placement to make sure anyone understands really what is happening in this child's life and what an appropriate placement would be. These are real things that happen, and we all know what happens to the adults when these children become adults and exit the system without ever having established a healthy relationship with an adult. So now I'm rambling. I was really working on preparing and making this succinct, but I'll try and wrap this up.
Thank you.
I guess it really comes down to the common sense factor. If a social worker doesn't have a reasonable caseload, the likelihood of making the right decisions for a child in a family is very, very low. And the likelihood of making bad decisions is high, because a social worker will not have time to get to know a child or their family and to explore the best options for a child. So I really urge the committee to support this bill, and I look forward to seeing what a difference it can make for our foster youth.
Question, Senator Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, from your perspective as an attorney and guardian ad litem, we've heard comments that often family members, grandparents, and friends are not contacted as they should be. What is the law in that case? Can you, as a grandparent or a family member or a sister or brother, can you intervene in the process and demand to be heard and become a part of that foster care?
Yes, you do have, and the department has obligations to notify grandparents at this time. And they do make a good effort. And things have improved over the years. But still, there's that time crunch. Or does anyone – sometimes it's hard to even find out who the family members are, because families are not going to trust you, and they're not going to just share that information. And sometimes even the healthier relatives have been estranged from the family. So, I mean, it's shocked me, but you can work with a family for a long time before you realize – oh, there is an aunt here, or there is a grandparent there. And they may be in another state, they may be in another town, and they may be a great resource, but it's been overlooked because there's no time to have those conversations.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you. Senator Marchicki has been with us for quite some time, so I just want that on the record. Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you.
We're going to go... back off net now, and the testimony that we were hearing was invited testimony. All testimony is good, but we've got another commitment coming up here, and we have like 8 or 9 people to get through, so I'm going to try to hold that testimony to 2 minutes, not be real stringent on that, but if we could get it done in 2 minutes with a wrap-up, that would be greatly appreciated. And for me, I don't know if I'm going to have much Kleenex left if on this testimony. So if we could start in Fairbanks, Natasha Singh, 2 minutes, please, with a wrap-up.
Hi, it's Natasha Singh from Fairbanks. I am representing Tenant on Chiefs Conference as well as the Alaska Regional Coalition, which includes Manilik, Koweric, Tlingit Haida, and Chugach-Mute. We are all in full support of House Bill 151. We agree with the testimony that we've heard, that this will be a game changer for our communities in Alaska. We believe right now our OCS workers are onboarded full with full intentions of doing the best for Alaska's children and families, but they're not given really the time it needs to actually work these cases to get the best outcomes for our family. In Fairbanks, we have an example where normally there's 4 rural workers. Right now, there's only 2. So these 2 workers are having to travel every single day to meet their federal mandates to see the children. So basically, there's no casework time in there to get what they need done. I adopted my son through OCS. He's my biological third cousin. And just witnessing it firsthand, the social workers, they're just so loving and committed to the case, but they just don't have the time. My cousin, who was the parent, she wasn't given at the front end the resources needed to really turn her life around. And it would have saved the state of Alaska a lot of money if they could have assisted her, but eventually her son was adopted to me. Her daughter was adopted out, and now she has become sober. But we have two children that if the caseworkers would have been given the proper time, and that's what we're asking for, to invest and to figure out her sources of strength, we could have kept two children being adopted out there. But just real thank you for your time. The Alaska Regional Coalition is representing Alaska Native tribes, and we have a real interest because of the high rates of Alaska Native children in custody. But this is really about families and communities. And while you might not think the child protection system impacts your life, it really does. From the criminal justice system to education, it has huge impacts. So we would just full support of empowering our OCS caseworkers. Thank you.
Natasha, thank you for your testimony. Seeing no comments, we'll go next to Tammy Sandoval in Anchorage. Tammy, if you could stay around 2 minutes with a wrap-up, it'd be greatly appreciated.
Thank you, and good morning. For the record, my name is Tammy Sandoval. I'm the director of the Child Welfare Academy at UAA. The Child Welfare Academy does all the training for new frontline workers, their supervisors, and social services associates, as well as a whole host of other trainings around the state. I am also Director Lawton's predecessor at OCS, and in my 34 years of experience in child welfare here and in two other states, I have never witnessed any magic or silver bullets to reform the child welfare system. It takes the kind of legislation that Representative Guerra is proposing in this bill. It takes enough qualified staff alongside community partners to address the complex issues that families are experiencing these days, more issues than I've ever seen in the past. The changes that were made last year were a good start. We added 2 more weeks of training and dedicated mentors who will help transfer the learning from the classroom to practice in the field. I know staff are grateful for those improvements, but it hasn't proved to be enough. That's why I support this bill. Workers are still coming to core training, having been assigned to cases, because workers who stay in their positions simply cannot carry the load when there are these high rates of vacancies. New workers need time to learn and integrate that learning into their practice, and because child welfare isn't just about common sense. It's tough work. There are a lot of requirements in addition to best practice. As the numbers of the reports of child maltreatment continues to increase, workers are losing hope that they can make a difference with children and families. We can pay now or we can pay later, but when we underserve families in child welfare, youth move on to juvenile justice, homelessness, and then to corrections. Let's do this right from the start, bolster child welfare services so that we can decrease adverse childhood experiences and the cycle continuing to repeat itself over and over. Please support House Bill 151 to improve outcomes for children, youth, and families. Thank you.
Tammy, thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Rachel Bedsworth in Anchorage facing foster care in Alaska. 2 minutes, please.
Hi, my name is Rachel Bedsworth, and I'm currently the statewide representative for Facing Foster Care in Alaska. This past October, I turned 21 and aged out of the system. During my time in care, I went in and out of the foster care system for 12 years, and during those 12 years, I moved through 47 placements. Within those 47 placements, 2 of them had actually testified here today. I lived with Julie Leckie, who dropped her job as my CASA volunteer and took me in when I was 14, who I actually got to go to the state fair with her family, as she mentioned earlier, as well as Amanda Matevier, who is currently my forever family. As well in those 47 placements, it includes all of the foster homes, all the friends' houses, the relatives' houses, the group homes and treatment centers I have lived in during those 12 years in care. During my time in the system, I went through 9 different social workers. I remember a time during 8th grade, I had gone through 3, maybe 4 social workers in a matter of 2 to 3 months. Children are supposed to achieve permanency, meaning they go home or they get a forever family, within 2 years of being placed in the system. For me, it took 12 years and almost 50 moves for me to find my forever family, That isn't okay, and this shouldn't be the case for any child. With consistency among caseworkers and realistic caseloads, we can change the foster care system for the better in the future for all foster youth coming in after me. Please support House Bill 151. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next, we're going to Desiree Shepler in Wasilla. Desiree, if you could put your name on the record in 2 minutes, please.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Desiree Shepler, and I'm the director of Raising Our Children with Kindness, or ROC Matsu. ROC Matsu is a place-based collective consisting of over 30 individuals and organizations that join together to promote family resilience and end child maltreatment in the Matsu Borough. The partners of ROC Matsu strongly support HB 151, as we see this bill as having the potential to greatly support OCS staff in achieving better outcomes for Alaska's most vulnerable children. HB 151 will increase training for OCF staff, ensuring they enter their positions with appropriate training to best serve children and families, reduce caseloads for OCS workers so they can provide proper oversight for each case and attention to each child on their caseload, and will help to create a pathway for families with a screened-out report of harm to access voluntary community support services to prevent families from ever entering the OCS system. In the Matsu Borough, just as in all of Alaska, OCS is struggling with an increase in child abuse and neglect cases. In the past 5 years, the number of OCS cases statewide has increased by 50%. The Palmer Court has seen the number of child in need of aid cases where children have been removed from their parents increase dramatically from 216 cases in 2014 to 242 cases in 2015 and 271 cases in 2016. ROC Matsu works closely with staff from our local OCS office, and together we have been able to achieve great things for families engaged in the child welfare system in Matsu, such as launching the first therapeutic court in Alaska for families with young children in the child welfare system. During our work together, we have also seen firsthand how committed to providing meaningful services to families in need OCS staff are. The partners of ROC Matsu see our support of HB 151 as a way to give back to OCS staff who give so much to their work. By reducing caseloads and increasing training for OCS staff, we are helping them to achieve the positive outcomes, such as increased contact with family members and decreased length of time in care that Alaska's children deserve. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Next, we're going to back to Anchorage. Sarah Redmond, 2 minutes, please.
Hi, my name is Sarah Edwin. I was in and out of the foster care system here in Alaska for 7 years of my life. I had 16 different placements and about 7 different caseworkers while in foster care. While being in foster care, I moved from different homes while being resident foster homes, treatment foster care, treatment foster homes, being homeless. And on my 21st birthday, I aged out in the foster care system without a permanent connection. To this day, I am still looking for a permanent connection. I am one of 12 siblings, so I am the fourth oldest. I have 8 younger ones that are below me. While in my biological home, I was the caretaker when my biological parents weren't around. So when we entered the foster care system, I was always worried about where my siblings were, what they were doing, if they were okay, were they getting fed. Just all those things that you worry about when you're not around your siblings, it affected me physically and emotionally, and it affected me still to this day. While being in foster care, I lost relationships with my siblings that I wish I had today. I think that if we were able to pass this bill and have sibling contact, it would reduce the harm that it has in the effects, long-term effects on youth and children in foster care. When you're the mother taker in your home, you worry about your siblings on a day-to-day basis. You're not just worried about yourself. You have other ones. So with this bill, it would really help. I think due to not having the contact with my siblings, it is because of the caseworkers. What my case had 14 people in it. If the caseworkers didn't have a ton more cases, they would be able to give more of their time to each individual case.
And I think that we would have been able to have better contacts with our siblings, knowing where they're at and everything. That's what my testimony for today. Thank you for letting me share.
Thank you for those comments. Next, we're going to go to Elizabeth Ripley, Mat-Su Health Foundation. 2 minutes, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Elizabeth Ripley, and I serve as CEO of the Mat-Su Health Foundation. The foundation shares ownership in Mat-Su Regional Medical Center and invests its profits back into the community to improve the health and wellness of Alaskans living in Mat-Su. The Mat-Su Health Foundation strongly supports HB 151. In 2013, the foundation and community partners conducted a Mat-Su Community Health Needs Assessment, where community members identified our number one community health goal: ensure all Mat-Su children are safe and well cared for. In response to this goal, the foundation created a focus area dedicated to building family resilience and preventing child maltreatment. Since that time, we've watched the number of Mat-Su maltreatment reports increase from 2,840 in 2014 to 3,528 in 2015, as reported by the Alaska Indicator-Based Information System for Public Health. The Palmer Court Child in Need of Aid cases also increased dramatically from 216 cases in 2014 to 242 in 2015 and 271 in 2016, largely due to the opioid epidemic. The foundation has become quite familiar with the caseload ratios, training deficits, and challenging conditions of the Mat-Su OCS office. This bill enacts evidence-based standards to improve outcomes, support families, enable faster timelines to permanency for children, and set caseworkers up for success. The foundation prioritizes working upstream. And HB 151 includes provisions to help prevent child maltreatment by allowing parents to opt into referrals to community organizations that can provide support services to the family in cases where OCS determines that services to protect the child are not required. This bill gives us a chance to keep families together and head off the escalation of abuse, saving heartache and money for Alaskans. The Mat-Su Health Foundation, like many of our nonprofit partners, local delegation members, and residents, recognize that Alaska's child welfare system needs reformed and supported to succeed. This legislation creates positive prevention and intervention standards that support youth and families and the caseworkers who serve them. We fully support HB 151 and urge you to do as well. Thank you.
Thank you for that testimony. Next, we're going to go to Michael Jeffrey, and all the way up to Utiavik, formerly known as Barrow.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michael Jeffrey. I'm a retired Superior Court judge. I was a Superior Court judge in Barrow for 32 years before I bumped up against the 70-year-old limit and had to retire. But during that time of service, I personally did the child welfare cases, juvenile justice cases, and felony cases, so I kind of saw the whole picture. I'm also a member of the Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee, but I am testifying on behalf of myself. I support HB 151, and it's tough to provide services on the North Slope. The distances are great, the costs are there, and there's a lot of turnover in the child welfare office, which I observed happen. And the bill's increased training, limits on caseloads will help retain workers who then have the experience working with Barrow and the villages, Utiavik and the villages, and will lead to so many benefits that you've heard at length. And I really support all the testimony that I've heard. I just wanted to go on record supporting this legislation. Another part of it that I love is that, and this is not really a monetary thing, but I just mentioned it, making it easier for a child that has aged out to contact their previous out-of-home caregivers who have kind of been parent figures And instead of everybody having to say, oh, I'm sorry, you're 18, I can't talk to you anymore. I don't know exactly what the regulations are, but to have that encouragement in the bill, I think, is very positive. And so thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Seeing no questions from committee members, we're at a point here where we're going to seek out and work with the bill sponsor to see if we can continue this work in our afternoon meeting. And I'd just like to say the public testimony is closed. Fiscal note will be held and reviewed at the next meeting, probably tomorrow. And so we will continue this discussion, I think, this afternoon. Representative Guerra, and we are adjourned.